cultural half-lives take on odd shapes, and I feel the present-day public perception of the universal monsters embodies this. I feel it's fair to say that as the initial releases of the films drift away from living memory, they've receded from pop culture ubiquity and have become something of museum pieces. Compared to the last 5 decades of horror cinema, the universal monsters can come off like relics of a bygone era, which is probably inevitable. I also don't think they're as widely seen as they were 70 to 80 years ago. Don't get me wrong, they still exist. I see DVDs at Target every October. My local theater screens many of them every Halloween, and I'm sure they're easy enough to find on streaming. Still, the odds of stumbling across Creature from the Black Lagoon on late-night TV is pretty slim these days. You have to actively seek out these films in order to watch them, and most people aren't inclined to do so unless they're horror nerds or have a serious interest in film history. Still, the half-life is undeniable. Ask a 4-year-old to do a Dracula voice, and you'll probably hear a Bela Lugosi impression, knowingly or not. The Mummy and the Wolfman will adorn paper plates at your next Halloween party, and Universal will try to reboot some aspect of their monster catalog every year or so. These characters aren't going away, even if a declining number of filmgoers ever bother with watching the movies themselves, or reading the source novels where applicable. I was born in the 80s, so I saw dozens of parodies, rip-offs, and spiritual progeny of Bride of Frankenstein before I sat through the proper film. Still, despite the decades of cultural half-life surrounding the feature, I was still struck by its tone, originality, and subtext. It soon became a personal favorite of mine, and I'm eager to talk about it here. My name is Ryan, this is a Real Deep Dive. Alright, joining me on this one is my brother Sylvan.
Hello.
And also my sister Cheryl.
Hi.
This is Sylvan's first time seeing it.
Yeah, and where I am fond of the Universal Monster movies and have been had the queer coding of this one talked up to me quite a bit, I feel bad about how long it took to get around to it.
I mean, you're a werewolf person.
I am mostly a werewolf person, yeah.
Yeah, so you hammered through the Wolfmans.
I did. But, you know, I like the monster movies in general, so this has been on the to-do list.
Cheryl saw it once and found it super boring, although it's been a while. He said it was a Toby ago.
Yes, it was an entire Toby ago. I usually see these movies when you make me watch them or when they pop up in the movie theaters.
So what's your take on Bride now? How'd you feel about it?
I still like Creature of the Black Lagoon better, but it wasn't as boring.
Wasn't as boring. Sylvan, how boring did you find it?
I mean, I did get distracted by my phone a couple of times. I think the movie suffered from some pacing issues, but overall I liked it.
We will be getting to the interesting editing history that this film had, because it's only 75 minutes long, which is short even by the standards of the day. It was 90 minutes in its initial cut. There's a story behind that.
Did it have more bride in the initial cut?
No, it did not.
Oh, okay. Cool. Because I feel like some of the scenes they chose to keep in could have been lifted right out.
Anyways, plot recap. We open in a castle that's very clearly a model on a stormy night. Percy Shelley and Lord Byron are praising Mary Shelley for her story of Frankenstein, mostly Lord Byron. By the way, the actor playing Lord Byron, his name is Gavin Gordon. And in case you were wondering, yes, he actually was gay. He was actually the longtime lover of Edward Everett Horton.
He did really interesting R roles, very unnecessarily.
Cheryl compared him to the Cowardly Lion.
Yeah, that's 100% accurate. If you've never seen this movie, that's all you need to think of.
This might become my default mental image of Lord Byron, though.
It has already happened for me. He also did Byron's limp. Like, he milked that scene for all he could get out of it. Anyways, Shelley reminds the two of them that her intention for writing the novel was to impart a moral lesson, the consequences of a mortal man who dares to try playing God. Mary says that she has more of the story to tell, in fact, and then the scene shifts to the close of the 1931 Frankenstein film, where the villagers are gathering around the burning windmill and cheering the apparent death of the monster.
There wasn't a lot going on that night.
I'd say there was quite a bit. There was a burning windmill with the monster inside.
Yeah, but like when we get there, that fire was already almost burned out.
Hans, the father of the girl that the creature drowns in the prior film, insists on seeing the monster's blackened bones himself. He then falls into a flooded pit underneath the mill, where the monster, having survived the fire, instantly strangles him. Hauling himself from the pit, the monster casts Hans's wife to her death, and then next encounters Baron Frankenstein's servant, Minnie, who flees in terror.
Hang on, though. Like, I mean, it's kind of nice in a terrible, like, murdery way that, like, technically they all died in the water. It's like the family's reunited.
He didn't manage to take out Minnie, though. She has quite the plot armor.
You were just like, Minnie should stay with Elizabeth and she'll be safe because of the plot armor. And he's like, Minnie's plot armor only seems to help her. The body of Henry Frankenstein, who is thought to have died in the windmill, is returned to his fiancée Elizabeth at their castle home. Minnie arrives to sound the alarm about the monster, but her warning goes unheeded. Meanwhile, Elizabeth, seeing Henry move, realizes that he is still alive.
Minnie saw Henry move and freaked the fuck out.
Yeah, Minnie's very excitable.
Yeah, that honestly, that seems to be her only mode.
Nursed back to health by Elizabeth, Henry has renounced his creation and his ambition to bring life to the dust of the dead, but he still believes that he may be destined to unlock the secret of life and immortality.
Yeah, so he hasn't renounced shit.
Noticing this, a hysterical Elizabeth cries that she foresees death.
And then she starts laughing maniacally, but it's okay. She doesn't get a lot of lines in this movie, so we don't have to worry about it.
Henry is interrupted from his recuperation by his former mentor, Dr. Septimus Praetorius.
That is such an awesome name. I didn't catch that his first name was Septimus. He's my favorite character, by the way. I'm sure you're shocked.
Yeah, he's my favorite character, too, and I am not the least bit surprised. Anyways, Praetorius convinces Henry to come to his lab in order to see several homunculi that he has created. A little queen, a little king, a ballerina, a bishop who's very judgy of all of them.
It was a boring ballerina, Ryan.
Yeah, she'll only dance the Mendelssohn.
And a little devil that looks suspiciously like him.
That devil was played by Praetorius' stand-in.
Oh, that's cute.
Praetorius wishes to work with Henry to create a female companion for the monster, with a proposed venture involving Praetorius growing an artificial brain while Henry gathers parts from the charnel house for the body itself.
I actually have a question for you, because I didn't get this and I paid attention to it. Why? Why did that guy want to make a lady?
Well, there is a line in there about how he wants to create life, but men of his particular condition are not able to do that naturally.
But he made a bunch of little guys.
He wants to make big dudes.
But why?
Because he wants to make big dudes.
Whatever.
Meanwhile, the monster encounters a young shepherdess who atavistically screams at the sight of him and falls in the river. He rescues her, but is mistaken as an assailant by the locals and is shot in the arm. The hunters then raise a mob that set out in pursuit. Captured and trussed to a pole, the monster is hauled to a dungeon and chained, and then immediately breaks the chains as soon as he's left alone because the burgomaster doesn't think that he's a monster, just an escaped lunatic. The monster then flees into the woods. That night, the monster encounters an old blind hermit who befriends the monster and thanks God for breaking his loneliness by sending another lost soul to be his companion.
Honestly, I have no idea why this movie isn't just called Friend of Frankenstein. Like, those scenes were the most impactful for me.
There were several title changes before they settled on Bride.
Just that one lady.
As a big Les Mis nerd, this whole section was just giving Valjean and Bishop of Dang to me.
You asked where the silver candlesticks were during the viewing.
Oh my god, it's so heavy-handed. Somebody read Les Mis and then wrote the script.
The hermit teaches the monster certain words, including friend and good.
And smoke.
And smoke. And he tries to teach the monster that fire can be good, but no, fire not good. In fact, fire may be bad.
Mmm. Do that to the mic.
Mmm.
Just made a yummy noise. Two lost hunters stumble upon the cottage, recognize the monster, and then start a fight which instantly results in the cottage burning down, and the hunters leading the hermit away, who's wondering what the hell's going on and where his friend went.
But, like, also, too, this blind guy has been living alone for years, possibly decades in the woods, in an incredibly flammable house, and he was doing fine.
Yeah, he seemed to have his own, like, winery and bread-making thing going on. Like, he was doing pretty good for a lonely hermit.
And he knows how to roll his cigars, and tobacco farming is very labor-intensive.
I know we'll probably get to this too, but I'm also so confused about, like, the clothing. Everybody's outfit is from a different era, if it's even from a real era, but I know that's part of the general universal mystique, that there's no real settings.
Yeah, this takes place in a section of Bavaria where everyone speaks with a transatlantic English accent. Anyways, taking refuge from the new angry mob in a crypt, the monster spies Praetorius and his cronies, Karl and Ludwig, breaking open a grave. Speaking of which, the lead goon, Karl, is played by Dwight Fry, who was Fritz, the hunchbacked helper in the first Frankenstein, who was basically murdered by the monster in the exact same fashion, and he's also Renfield in Dracula, so he doesn't catch a break in anything. The henchmen depart as Praetorius decides just to have dinner in the tomb.
Oh, wait, this one's for Sylvan. Did you also think that that little, like, 19-year-old child's bones looked like the bones from Animal Crossing?
I didn't really stop to think of it.
I just really liked how they were arranged in, like, the exact same way. It was a nice little pile. I'm like, oh, it's cute! Wait.
The monster reveals himself, and then a delighted Praetorius shares his wine and food with him, and decides, hey, if I tell this guy about making a female companion for him, I can now have that be leverage for my reluctant Henry Frankenstein.
I was gonna say, I'm like, this guy's just having his dinner in a crypt, and then Leverage just walks right on in. He's like, this thing can't get any better. Woohoo!
Henry and Elizabeth, now married, are visited by Praetorius. Henry expresses his refusal to assist Praetorius, and then that's when the monster comes in. The monster demands that Henry help, to no avail. Praetorius then orders the monster out, secretly signaling him to kidnap Elizabeth. Praetorius then guarantees Elizabeth's safe return upon Henry's participation in creating the Bride of Frankenstein. Henry returns to the Tower Laboratory and, despite himself, grows enthusiastic over his work. After being assured of Elizabeth's safety with a new device called the telemophone, Henry completes the bride's body. Although, they had a hard time finding a heart that'll work, so, you know, one of the goons is sent out to get a fresh one from the accident hospital, and Henry's like, sudden accidents happen all the time. Praetorius is like, oh yeah, definitely. We're not just gonna kill a random girl and take her heart over to you.
I mean, it didn't have to be a girl. Maybe it's like a donkey heart.
We saw the murder.
Yeah, I know.
A storm rages as final preparations are made to bring the bride to life. Her bandage-wrapped body is raised through the roof, where electricity is harnessed from the lightning in order to animate her. Henry and Praetorius lower her, and after realizing their success in bringing her to life, remove her bandages and help her to stand. This is when the monster comes down the steps, after killing Karl on the rooftop, and he sees the bride. The monster reaches out to her and asks if she is going to be his new friend. The bride screamingly rejects him. He observes that she hates me, like others. As Elizabeth, who apparently has escaped her confinement in some capacity, races to rejoin Henry, the monster rampages through the lab. Before destroying everything, the monster pauses and tells Henry and Elizabeth to go. You live. And then turns to Praetorius and the bride and saying, we stay, we belong dead. While Henry and Elizabeth flee, the bride hisses at the monster. Shedding a tear, the monster pulls the lever to trigger the laboratory and tower's destruction. End of film. Bride of Frankenstein had a very laborious development. The box office success of the original Frankenstein in 1931 all but mandated a sequel in the eye of Universal executives, but James Whale felt that any follow-up would pale in comparison, and he refused to return to the director's chair for years. Kurt Newman was briefly slated to replace Whale, but he elected to direct The Black Cat instead, which wound up being a good move for him. That's probably the most beloved Universal horror movie that doesn't star one of the monsters. After The Invisible Man was a smash, Universal heads Carl Laemmle Jr. became convinced that Whale and only Whale was fit to direct the Frankenstein sequel. Sensing his advantage, Whale convinced Universal to greenlight his pet project One More River as part of the deal. While Laemmle was vacationing in Europe, producers dangled total creative control in front of Whale, and that got him to sign on.
Good for him.
Still convinced that any attempt to top the expressionist atmospherics and gruesome jump scares in Frankenstein would underwhelm audiences who are now accustomed to Karloff's makeup job, Whale decided to lean into camp and melodrama instead, deciding that Bride of Frankenstein should just be a big ol' hoot.
I mean, it came right after The Invisible Man, and that was a hoot.
Is that also why there was so much Minnie?
Perhaps.
Aw, come on, we couldn't get The Invisible Man instead?
He also decided to have the monster learn to speak, but only at a 10-year-old's level. With the help of a psychiatrist employed by the studio, Whale also decided that the monster would have the emotional maturity of a 15-year-old.
That explains the ending.
Yeah, this comes in stark contrast to how the monster is depicted in the novel, where he is an unflattering caricature of Lord Byron and a bit swishy. They decided that personal characteristic should be channeled into a different character, which eventually became Dr. Pretorius.
Yeah.
Karloff vehemently opposed writing spoken dialogue for the monster, thinking that the appeal of the creature was found in the ambiguity of his physical acting and his facial expressions. Boris Karloff, however, was overruled. The first script was by Robert Florey, who completed it in 1932, well before Whale agreed to return. After it was rejected, Tom Reed wrote a treatment under the title of The Return of Frankenstein. Universal would retain this particularly unambitious title until well after shooting began. Reed's full script passed the Hays Code in 1933, but Whale hated it and demanded that somebody else start from scratch. Whale also rejected a script by L.G. Blockman and Philip MacDonald. In 1934, John L. Balderston wrote a script focusing on a plot point from the Mary Shelley novel that the 1931 Frankenstein film abandoned, the monster demanding Frankenstein create a female companion for himself. In the novel, Frankenstein destroys the lady monster before he's even able to bring it to life, and the monster kills Elizabeth in revenge. But Balderston had the monster's maid come alive and bring about the story's climax. Balderston also came up with the Mary Shelley, Percy Shelley, and Lord Byron prologue that ultimately opens the movie. Whale liked those bits, but he disliked Balderson's script as a whole and requested heavy revisions from playwright William J. Hurlbut and Edmund Pearson.
These people have amazing names.
Hurlbut is the only credited writer, although Whale did heavy revisions and also included lots of drawings. This script met with Whale's approval, and it was resubmitted to the Hays office. There's a persistent rumor that the Hays censors rejected a plot point where Dr. Pretorius kills Elizabeth and puts her heart in the bride, but there's little evidence that Whale ever intended this to happen.
That would have been bitchin', though.
Or the casting for this. First we have Colin Clive as Henry Frankenstein. Universal wanted to replace Clive because his alcoholism had worsened considerably since his marriage fell apart. A Whale, however, believed that Clive's manic yelling was a core component of Frankenstein's success and refused to recast him.
I mean, that is one of the aspects of the movie that is retained in popular culture, so probably not wrong.
Whale considered one of the most iconic parts to be Clive screaming, "It's alive, alive!"
I mean, he's not wrong.
He had him do it again. Clive's drinking did interfere with filming. He sometimes had to be physically held up by crew members for close-ups and over-the-shoulder shots.
This is a different era of filmmaking.
Clive also broke his leg in the middle of shooting. This is why Frankenstein is seated for most of the movie.
That happens a lot when we do these.
Clive made about half a dozen movies in 1935 alone, but his drinking soon made him unemployable. He would be dead less than 2 years later at the age of 37.
Oh gosh.
Wait a minute. He was younger than me when he made this?
Yes.
Very different era.
All right, then we have Boris Karloff as the monster. This was a rough shoot for Karloff. Should mention that he was 48 years old and was still suffering from severe arthritis at this point.
Oh, hang on, I have a guess. Did he get pneumonia from wearing all that heavy makeup and being constantly in water?
No, but he did lose 20 pounds.
Aww.
Prosthetics and makeup took about 5 hours. There was a scene where he was in the water, but air shot into him, and because the clothing was so tight, he blew up like a balloon.
Oh my god!
The next day, he dislocated his hip during one of the action scenes in the water. He either elected to or was pressured into soldiering on. Accounts vary. Whale arranged to have heating pads and an on-site masseuse to help him get through it, but he was in a great deal of pain for most of this movie.
I don't know. know why they used water at all at that point in time in filmmaking. I don't know why they use it today.
To be honest, I'm shocked that Universal talked him into a third Frankenstein movie after this one. All right, then we have Valerie Hobson as Elizabeth.
She was in the movie.
Yeah, she was a last-minute replacement for Mae Clark, who played Elizabeth in the first one, but was too sick to appear in this one.
So, I'd say that's a fine metaphor, because my big feelings about Elizabeth as a character are, he's not worth it, just leave.
Also, Hobson was 17, while Clive was 35.
That sounds about right for Hollywood.
Yep. Hobson is best known for her second marriage to John Profume, a British cabinet minister who lied about an affair under oath, causing massive scandal in the early 60s. Andrew Lloyd Webber wrote a musical about the incident.
Do you know what the musical is called? Because I'm instantly curious.
God, I should have written it down. It was about a different person who was involved in the scandal. But yeah, never mind that, because we have Ernest Thesiger as Dr. Praetorius.
Ooh, Silhouette's favorite.
Woot woot.
Universal wanted Claude Rains or Bela Lugosi for this part, but Whale was adamant that Thesiger and Thesiger alone was the right choice for Praetorius.
I mean, he does light up his scenes.
I don't think Claude Rains is the wrong answer ever, but...
Yeah, no, I mean, that would have been a great movie too, but this man was the highlight of the film.
Not Minnie. Minnie didn't do it for you.
I mean, Minnie's fine, but she's always the same.
This might surprise you, but Thesiger was incredibly gay in real life.
No.
He also spent decades in the theater before he got involved in movies.
Yeah, that comes through too.
Thesiger spent most of the shoot's downtime working on his needlepoint. He had just taken up needlepoint.
That is the sweetest thing ever, and I really wish that they had put that in the movie.
He also hung up his creations with price tags. I have no idea how many he sold. Yeah, he's the most fun part of this movie, he's the campiest part of this movie, and he's also the gayest part of this movie.
So, like, all of those things should be synonymous.
He's a triple threat.
Alright, then we have Elsa Lanchester as Mary Shelley and also the bride.
She's certainly in this movie a bit.
She gets something to do with Shelley.
She's bookends.
She is best known as Charles Lawton's wife, although she said in her autobiography that it wasn't a particularly happy marriage and that Lawton was gay, and that's why they didn't have any kids, although Lawton's surviving relatives claimed that the reason that Lanchester didn't have any children was because she was rendered infertile by a botched abortion.
Sounds like a whole lot of bitterness all around.
The Bride is the most well-known role that she ever played, but she did have a long career, often acting alongside Lawton. Often they played villainous characters together. She got Best Supporting Oscar nods for Come to the Stable and Billy Wilder's Witness for the Prosecution, one of the two Agatha Christie adaptations that Christie actually liked. The Bride's hiss was inspired by some mean-spirited swans that Lancaster had an unpleasant encounter with in the park.
Cheryl, do you have something to say on this?
I mean, that is perfect. I'm sorry. I had no idea, and I love it, and I instantly understand. Carry on.
According to Lanchester, her stand-ins quit because they felt claustrophobic under the bride's wrappings. She declined all food and water during the shoot because going to the bathroom became too much of a hassle. She did praise Whale as a thoughtful and good-natured craftsman who knew how to keep the cast and crew in good spirits over the long hours of filmmaking. She was less fond of makeup artist Jack Pierce, whom she considered arrogant. She largely credits Whale for the bride's iconic look.
Obviously, I know what the Bride of Frankenstein looks like, but mostly through it trickling out into popular culture. This was my first time taking a good, solid look at the character, and I gotta say, the makeup really is very iconic. The sharp brows and, the full dark lipstick, that is definitely lingered around in goth culture.
Her makeup job took 3 hours, as opposed to Karloff, it took 5. Alright, then we have not Sylvan's favorite character, Una O'Connor as Minnie.
I mean, I don't mind her, but I think she would have worked better. She works in small doses, you know? They just gave her a little too much in this. I think Cheryl would agree.
Yeah, I mean, by the end of it, I just didn't... every time she makes a face, it's like her eyes get so big like an owl. So when the actual owl kept showing up, I just lost it.
O'Connor was a character actress who played maids, nannies, wives, and servants. The Irish Times listed her at number 19 on their list of the greatest Irish film actors.
Jesus Christ.
Whale used her as a nosy landlady in The Invisible Man, and she's essentially the same character here. Personally, I think O'Connor's best performance is as Maid Marian's attendant in the Errol Flynn Robin Hood movie. She's basically playing the same role there. She's like, I don't think Missy should run off the Sherwood Forest with this outlaw. Until one of the merry men takes a shine to her, and she's like, oh, I can get some dick out of this? Let's go to the woods.
Oh yeah, I remember that.
Then we have OP Heggie as the Hermit. Heggie was busy with another project, but Whale insisted that he play the Hermit. Whale shut down production of the movie for 10 days so he could wait until Heggie was available. I mean, Cheryl did say that the scenes with the Hermit are the most affecting, and yeah, it's hard for me to disagree with that.
Yeah, I think he did an amazing job. Do I think that the movie should have got... Like, there's no way the budget was okay with that, but like, yeah. No, he was good. I liked him.
Despite all of the very pointed and theatrical melodrama, the bit where the monster lays down, a single tear trickles down his cheek, that feels genuine, at least on some level.
I just like that he learned how to hold hands from that man, and when he's trying to befriend the female monster, he's like, oh wait, wait, we haven't held hands yet. That's gonna solve it. It worked for me.
I mean, I liked all those story beats in Les Mis, so sure, it's good.
And that whole Hermit bit was also in the Mary Shelley novel and then abandoned in the first Frankenstein movie, so nice that they left room for it here.
With how much the monster loved bread, I love that you keep connecting it to Les Mis.
Oh yeah, tore right into that sucker.
Marilyn Harris, who played the little girl that the monster accidentally drowned in the first Frankenstein, gets a cameo as one of the kids who discovers the monster here. Whale even had her yell out look so he could pay her for a speaking role.
Oh, that's so cute. And Cheryl's heart is melting.
It's just so sweet. What a good guy. No wonder they said nice things about him. Don't ruin it for me. I saw you look at your notes.
Shooting began on January 2nd, 1935, with a proposed budget of $293,000, roughly half of the original Frankenstein's budget. Because of delays, onset injuries, and other complications, Bride went over $100,000 over budget, even though it was shot exclusively on sound stages. Makeup artist Jack Pierce wanted to preserve continuity with the prior film, altering Karloff's makeup to show singed hair and facial burns from the windmill fire. The monster's burns also gradually heal and scar over as the film progresses. The bride's famous hairdo is modeled after busts of the ancient Egyptian queen Nefertiti. Lanchester's hair was permed over a wireframe for this effect, and a lot of people agree that this is mostly Whale's idea.
I know one of the bits of, like, obvious trivia that comes up a lot is that the bride's hair is actually red instead of black because it's her actual hair. And for some reason in popular culture, it gets remembered as black. It doesn't even, like, being a black and white movie, though, it doesn't look black.
Yeah, Kenneth Strickfaden brought back all of the whirring, buzzing, and functionally useless electronic gizmos he made in his garage for fun and then loaned to the first Frankenstein's production. He also built some new stuff, each with fanciful nicknames like the Cosmic Ray Diffuser and the Nebularium.
I really genuinely think those are amazing band names, and we should get cracking after this. I want to be part of the Nebularium.
Universal used one of Strickfaden's lightning bolts as stock footage in dozens of genre films for years after Bride of Frankenstein came out. Most of the effects work were supervised by John P. Fulton, particularly for the homunculi scene. The homunculi actors were shot over the course of 2 days, and they performed in full-size glass jars set against black velvet.
That also sounds awesome. That should be part of our band, like, stage setting.
This was later rotoscoped and matted into the corresponding shots with Clive and Thesinger using techniques refined from The Invisible Man. A homunculi infant played by little person actor Billy Barty was cut from the film in post, although Barty is briefly visible in one shot. Universal was opposed to Whale using his regular cinematographer John J. Mescal due to his drinking problem. But Whale put his foot down yet again. Mescal was talented and quick. He was also a functioning alcoholic who usually did good work even when he was hammered. Frankenstein is one of the first 360-degree pans in Hollywood cinema, and the camera moves a lot in this one. Cheryl likened the camera to a sneaky little spy who's just sort of like ducking around corners while people are talking privately.
Yeah, it made me think of the Hamburglar.
Bride is often cited as Mescal's finest work, although his contribution to Whale's 1936 version of Showboat comes up in the conversation as well. Yes, Whale also directed Hollywood musicals. For the music on this, Whale bumped into Franz Waxman at a party and, impressed with Waxman's score for Fritz Lang's 1934 film Lilium, insisted that he compose for Bride of Frankenstein. Having just fled Europe and still recovering from a severe beating he received from a gang of Nazis, Waxman jumped at the chance. Whale asked Waxman to write the theme music that doesn't resolve and therefore has an unsettling effect. Sylvan found the theme uncharacteristic and distracting for the scenes where the bride is revived with lightning.
One of you described it as meet-cute music, and it has that effect. It's kind of jaunty.
The strings and the horns kind of have a lilting effect, but once again, it doesn't resolve. Yeah, I do think that theme works when the bride is, like, stood up, but yeah, it is a little jaunty for the scenes with the lightning and the kites and one of the henchmen being thrown over the cliff to his doom.
I mean, it's not like Baby's Day Out music, but, like, yeah, I see it.
Whale also insisted on a dissonant chord to signal the destruction of the laboratory. Konstantin Bakalinikov conducted 22 musicians in a single 9-hour session in order to record the score. Bride wound up being Waxman's Hollywood breakthrough. He would later score Rebecca, Sunset Boulevard, A Place in the Sun, Stalag 17, and Rear Window. Bernard Herrmann called Waxman's score for Taras Bulba one of the best ever. Waxman's favorite piece overall, however, was The Song of Terezin, a choral work based on letters written by children in Nazi death camps. Universal would recycle the bride's score often, notably in the Buck Rogers serials.
Buck Rogers was a real thing?
Yep.
Yeah.
I've heard that referred to and stuff, and I just thought it was, like, I don't know, something that was, like, Whack Donald's in anime, just people use it.
Bride of Frankenstein came under heavy Hays Code scrutiny. As I already mentioned, the first edit of Bride ran for 90 minutes, with the theatrical cut hacked down to 75. For one thing, producers wanted Henry to survive the destruction of the laboratory because we're all invested in him.
What?
I know. What?
Welsh reshot the ending, but the explosions were too costly to redo. As such, Henry is visibly trapped in the laboratory room while the explosions are going off, even though he had just escaped a moment earlier.
What was that vampire movie we watched where they had, like, an out-of-body experience? Maybe that's how he got out.
However, Hays censors are responsible for most of the film's edits. They objected to many of the Christian allegories in Bride of Frankenstein. A great deal of dialogue comparing Frankenstein to God was either trimmed or removed, although a good chunk of it survived. There was a bit where Dr. Praetorius refers to science resurrecting the dead, or if you believe in your fairy tales, God. This was changed to, or if you believe in your Bible stories, God. An irate Whale instructed Thesiger to say Bible stories with a sneer.
I mean, it works.
A scene where the monster stumbles through a graveyard, notices a carving of Jesus on the cross, and naively tries to rescue Jesus was removed. A number of murder scenes were removed, including one where a villager kills his uncle and then blames the monster for it.
I mean, that makes sense when they run into the hut being like, oh, that's the monster that done did all the murders.
The prologue had to be altered because the Hays censors felt that Mary Shelley's cleavage was too prominent. They also objected to dialogue where Lord Byron denounces monogamy.
I feel like that's one of those things that they put it in there knowing that it was going to get cut. Just be like, maybe they'll be, I'll pacify them. Get that one and leave the rest in.
Yeah, make them feel like they did something. Universal also had Whale add a scene where the monster wreaks havoc on a Romani camp. Waxman's score had already been recorded at that point, so that scene has no music in it.
Oh, that's the one where she's like, needs pepper.
Salt and pepper.
Salt and pepper.
England and China objected to scenes where the monster gazes longingly at the bride prior to her reanimation, feeling that this promoted necrophilia. Sweden demanded so many cuts that Universal just decided to not bother releasing Bride of Frankenstein there at all.
Well, hang on, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I just kind of want to unpack that one. So the living monster being attracted to the other living monsters, necrophilia?
Well, she's not alive yet.
Oh, okay, on the table, on the table.
Yeah,
I'm
she's
sorry.
On the table.
Gotcha.
Trinidad, Palestine, and Hungary banned the film. Japan objected to the scene where Dr. Praetorius chases the little homunculi king around with tweezers, thinking that this was degrading to royalty and therefore the emperor.
I know, I'm still stuck on it. Do you think that if it's between two dead people, it's still necrophilia?
You know what? I think that most film censors in the 1930s would just err on the side of it being gross in terms of zombie humping in any capacity.
Okay, fine. Fair enough. Carry on.
Bride of Frankenstein premiered at the Orpheum Theater in San Francisco on April 19th and began rolling out into the general release the following day. As we've talked about in previous episodes, releasing a movie nationwide on the same week is a fairly new phenomenon. It's basically dates back to The Godfather. Generally, you would start it in a few small regions and then roll it out incrementally based upon word of mouth and what have you, and that's essentially what happened with Bride of Frankenstein. It did very well for itself, making about $2 million in its initial run, a profit of about $950,000 for Universal. Reviews were positive, albeit qualified. Many contemporary reviews said that it was essentially pretty good for a horror movie, as horror was not seen as a serious art form deserving of proper critical scrutiny.
Yes, this is only a problem that the past has had with the genre.
We are better at it now, especially since we're living in this post-Get Out heightened horror movie where it could be a little more artisanal. Also, it's good for those who believe in auteur theory, because in terms of theatrically released movies, horror is basically last venue where the director actually gets final say, as opposed to, say, whoever's running Marvel at the moment. Bride of Frankenstein's reputation has grown substantially in the years following its release. It's now usually seen as Whale's magnum opus, and also among the best of the Universal Monster films. Also, it usually makes lists of, like, best sequels ever made. It was added to the National Film Registry in 1998.
Well, I guess I'm gonna be comfortable being wrong then.
You didn't care for it?
I mean, I liked it better this time around than the last time I watched it. I think the company that I was keeping definitely improved it, but...
There were a number of sequels and homages. I'll just do the obvious ones. Son of Frankenstein followed in 1939, starring Basil Rathbone, Bela Lugosi, and Karloff in his final performance as the monster. Journeyman director Roland V. Lee replaced Whale as director. He was on the outs at Universal at that time. This is generally seen as the last canonical Universal Frankenstein film of quality. Ghost of Frankenstein followed in 1942 with Lon Chaney Jr. as the monster. Having Lon Chaney Jr. replace the monster is usually a bad sign.
Have you seen that one? Do you know the plot of it?
Yeah, it's kind of your typical...
Is he a ghost?
No, he's not a ghost.
Okay.
There is some brain switching involving, like, the hunchback assistant. It's a little contrived. Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman debuted a year later with Bela Lugosi playing the monster there. This set up further monster mashes with House of Frankenstein in 1944 and House of Dracula in 1945.
I like that you did monster mash. Sorry, carry on.
These movies are corny as hell, and for the most part not very good, although I think they do have a degree of campy charm to them, particularly House of Dracula. The last hurrah for Universal Frankenstein was 1948's Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein.
That one's delightful.
It is. The next major film release featuring the character was 1957's The Curse of Frankenstein, which featured Peter Cushing and Christopher Lee in a very, very different take on the story. Okay, you might not have heard of this, but Mel Brooks would lampoon the first three Universal Frankensteins with 1974's Young Frankenstein, co-written and starring Gene Wilder. Madeline Kahn played the closest thing to an analog for The Bride, with Gene Hackman doing an uncredited cameo as the Hermit. 1998's Gods and Monsters dramatizes the final years of James Whale's life. Ian McKellen plays Whale, with Brendan Fraser playing his hot young gardener. The title lifts dialogue from Bride, and the film is prominently featured throughout Gods and Monsters' largely fictionalized plot. Brendan Fraser's character is made up entirely.
Yeah, but it's nice to just slide him into movies.
the bride's appearances in outside media are a little bit limited. There is an officially licensed sequel novel that Dark Horse published in the 2000s that implies that the bride and Dr. Pretorius survived the explosion, and he's, like, doing this little Bride of Frankenstein charm school a la Pygmalion or My Fair Lady.
I mean, I think it sounds cute. It reminds me of the Scooby-Doo one where, like, Shaggy is, like, running, like, a school for monster girls.
Yeah, I feel like that could be done really well. I'd be interested. For other media, would you count Frankie Stein from Monster High?
Yeah, sure, why not?
The LGBTQ youth group I work at, I was subjected to one of the Monster High movies for one of our movie nights, and Frankie Stein is canonically and explicitly non-binary and heavily autistic coded, and I greatly enjoyed that character.
As of this recording, Lisa Frankenstein is in theaters. I have ambivalent feelings about Diablo Cody, so I'm not sure if I'm gonna like that or not, or even bother sitting through it.
Ooh, my husband and I almost saw that on Thursday.
I got burned for it pretty bad by Tully.
We wound up choosing the new Willy Wonka movie, but yeah, we almost saw that one.
Yeah, in terms of comic books, both Marvel and DC have Frankenstein monsters running around. The Marvel one never bothered with the bride, but in recent years of New 52, they decided to make the Frankenstein monster a secret agent who is an agent of this spy organization called SHADE. Obviously, SHADE is an acronym, and he runs a group called the Creature Commandos. So there's, like, a secret agent Dracula, and a secret agent Mummy, and a secret agent Gill Lady, who's, like, his love interest. And he's divorced from the bride there. There's a lot of bad blood between them. They used to have intense feelings for each other, and they respect each other, but they've kind of moved on. It's a nice difference from, say, the confrontation in Bride, which Sylvan has feelings about.
Yeah, and Charles seems to share those as well. So I feel like in the ending there, the monster doesn't really give her much of a chance to, you know, she just came to life. Of course, she's freaking out. She is cobbled together from different people's body parts. She's trying to make sense of the world. This guy is immediately hitting on her, and she freaks out. Of course she does. And he just immediately decides to blow her up because he doesn't fall in love with her right away. Or fall in love with him right away. Like, it's very, very incel behavior.
The monster does have the emotional intelligence of a 15-year-old, canonically, and that plays into the climax.
Yeah, I guess not wrong, but anyway, despite the title of the movie being The Bride of Frankenstein, boy, she isn't really considered very deeply, is she?
Yeah, as we've already discussed, Bride of Frankenstein was a last-minute title change. They made this film not thinking that the bride was going to be seen as the main character, and that definitely shows.
Or even an important character.
I mean, she gets more to do than in the novel, where she's not even reanimated at all.
I kind of like her not being reanimated at all better, though, than her only lines being...
I mean, unless you
I do like the goose hiss, though.
The goose hiss is nice. And also, she does get to be Mary Shelley. I'm glad she got to be Mary Shelley. She got lines. But the themes that I wrote down, the first one I did was Christian allegory. Despite the best efforts of the Hays Code, Bride of Frankenstein is loaded with Christian iconography, up to and including a crucifixion of the monster.
Which was far more effective than the chains. That chain chair did not hold up.
Not even a little bit. Dracula is usually cited as the inverted bizarro Jesus, as he is an undead monster that rises from his grave to steal our blood and thereby corrupt and damn us. Still, the resurrection of the Frankenstein monster certainly makes him a contender for an inverted bizarro Jesus.
Oh my gosh, I'm so sorry. I did not mean to startle you. I just, when you were mentioning what he was doing, like, in, like, how he would murder people, like, he didn't steal blood. He drowned, like, most of his victims. Oh, do you think that's how he met his new, like, girlfriend partner? Because he couldn't drown the fish lady? And they're like, ha ha, oh my gosh, yeah, I don't drown. Like, a little cute meat cute.
I like it.
Sorry, go ahead.
Headcanon accepted. But yeah, this goes right back to the source. Shelley's novel was subtitled The Modern Prometheus, underpinning that Frankenstein's work was in defiance of divine authority, although this does seem to conflict with her husband's depiction of Prometheus. No shortage of Frankenstein adaptations zoom in on how resurrecting the dead is unnatural and blasphemous. Pop culture during the Cold War would frequently double down on science venturing into terrain that humanity wasn't meant to go to. As I've discussed on most of the 1950s sci-fi movies we've covered on this podcast, I am opposed to this narrative overall. Nuclear energy can be used for good or evil. That depends on us. I think that learning more about the universe we live in is a good thing, and we should do more of it. I think that H.P. Lovecraft was a douchebag terrified of leaving his house.
Woohoo!
Just once, I'd like to see a movie where a trailblazing scientist is warned that his research is dangerous and in defiance of God's will. But the scientist perseveres, and it turns out that their work breaks down a great barrier and objectively makes the world a better place for everyone. Fuck you, naysayers.
When, like, a lot of scientists are, like, Christian, like, I just don't get it. It's fine. But we have the little dairy packets that you don't have to refrigerate because of atheists.
Yeah, that's right. Atheist pride. Okay, now we're getting to the meaty part of this, and the one that we can't avoid talking about, not that we are planning to. Queer coding.
Woo!
James Whale was openly gay in an era where that was extremely difficult or completely unthinkable for most queer people. In the years following his death, many have re-examined Whale's catalog through a queer lens. This isn't difficult. The monster is hated and hounded for his immutable differences. The public reacts to the monster's mere existence with atavistic revulsion, something that the universe of the film sees as innate, but the narrative of the film clearly frames as wrong. This also comes straight for the source. Shelley clearly states that the monster was a naive child who was molded into a hateful beast by a society that shunned him for his ugliness. Bride of Frankenstein embraces campy theatricality and melodrama on top of all of this, which, if you haven't heard about this before, are hallmarks of queer theater culture.
It's true.
Whale's loved ones dispute this, however. Whale's lover, high-powered Hollywood producer David Lewis, insisted that Whale was an artist first and a gay man second. He claimed that the monster's sympathetic outsider status was actually rooted in Whale's background as a poor kid in a very class-conscious, stratified society. He added that Whale's time in a German POW camp during World War I was also a factor. This is also the time where Whale discovered his love for the arts. I saw some watercolor paintings he did while he was in the POW camp, so he was treated better than certain other people captured by the Germans.
I think it's interesting that he would say that depicting an aspect of your life through metaphor, through your sexual orientation ostracizing you through metaphor, wouldn't count as art by that description. What? Like, what?
It's just a no concept of art therapy.
I think it's also maybe, like, a knee-jerk reaction to, like, don't call him a gay artist because that might ghettofy him.
Yeah, I guess.
But another thing is that you could say, like, the monster is a metaphor for his queerness ostracizing him, or it's a metaphor for him growing up as a working poor kid ostracizing him, and it's like, those aren't mutually exclusive reads. But Whale's acolyte, Curtis Harrington, who continued Whale's legacy of campy, queer-coded horror movies throughout the 1970s with What's the Matter with Helen and Whatever Slew Auntie Rue, also disputes this.
Charles' face just lit up.
I haven't seen it, but it's on my bucket list.
Well, it's also super gay.
It's what my nephew calls me. Not super gay, Auntie Rue. I'd be fine with both, I guess.
Harrington believed that while a queer reading of Bride is possible, he doubts that Whale consciously set out to use the monster as a metaphor for the gay experience. The nice thing, however, about Death of the Author is that once the artist steps away from the art and releases it to the public, it no longer belongs to just them. The final collaborator on any work of art is the audience. They will bring their own experiences to the work, and they will interpret what they experience based on that. I can buy that Whale didn't consciously try to make Bride a gay film, but he was a gay man, and that would influence how he puts a story together and how he sees the world.
And, you know, put in a really fucking gay character with a gay actor just swishing all over the place, too.
Yeah, it's hard to say that he didn't know what he was doing with Dr. Septimus Pretorius.
No, he's just supposed to be very refined. He's very refined.
No, don't get Claude
right,
Rains.
You know.
Get the gay needlepoint theater guy to do it.
That's still just so lovely. A lot of stitching on that set.
Yeah, if you're expecting me to conclude that, like, Bride of Frankenstein isn't gay, no, Bride of Frankenstein is quite gay. All right, and that is everything that I have written down for Bride of Frankenstein. Is there anything that either of you would like to chime in before we close things up?
I genuinely had no idea that there was like a metal mesh under her hair, and I should have known that that's how they did it, but I just, like, you solved a mystery of my whole childhood.
Yeah, that is a gravity-defying bob there.
I'm good. We got to talk about the 15-year-old boy tantrum.
Fantastic. Thanks for listening, everybody. Join us next time.